Melzar led the caravan on a slightly different route back, curving westward to take in the foothills of the Sardauk mountain range. It was an area of low valleys with wide floors, mostly wooded, home to a huge variety of native creatures. There were few paths other than those carved out by the herds of chamelans that grazed on the pastures between the forests. Farsight and the G-wolves also sniffed out dragon pit traps that would have swallowed a G-horse and rider. The draken were burrowing animals the size of cats, with five legs in the usual Querentia arrangement of two on each side and a thick, highly flexible limb at the rear that helped them make their loping run. The front two limbs had evolved into ferociously sharp claws that could dig through soil at a phenomenal rate. They were hive animals, digging their vast warrens underground with populations over 100 strong. Singly they were harmless, but they attacked in swarms that even a well-armed human had trouble fighting off. Their ability to excavate big caverns just below the surface provided them with the means to trap their prey. Even the largest native creatures were susceptible to the pit traps. A biannual hunt had eliminated the draken from the lands around Ashwell, but in the wild they were prevalent. Watching for them heightened Eddiard's senses as they passed through the endless undulating countryside. On the third day out of Witham, they reached the fringes of the foothills and entered one of the massive forests there, parts of which reached across to the base of the Sardauks themselves. Eddiard had never been in a forest this size before. According to Melzar, it predated the arrival of humans on Querentia 2,000 years before. The sheer size of the trees seemed to back up his claim. They were tall and tightly clustered, their trunks dark and lifeless for the first 50 feet, until they burst into a thick, interlaced canopy where branches and leaves struggled against one another for light. Little grew on the floor beneath, and in the summer, when the leaves were in full bloom, not much rain dripped through. A huge blanket of dead, crisped leaves covered the ground, hiding hollows from sight, requiring the humans to use their farsight to guide the G-horses safely around crevices and snags. It was quiet in the gloom underneath the verdant living awning, the still air amplifying the mildest whisper to a shout that reverberated the length of the plodding caravan. The apprentices slowly abandoned their banter, becoming silent and nervous.
"We'll make camp in a valley, I know," Melzar announced after midday. "It's an hour away, and the forest isn't as wretched as it is here. There's a river as well. We're well past the trial and egg season, so we can swim."
"We're stopping there," Genral asked. "Isn't that early?"
"Don't get your hopes up, my lad. This afternoon you're going galbi hunting."
The apprentices immediately brightened. They had been promised hunting experience, but had not expected it to be galbis, which were large canine equivalents. Eddiard often had heard experienced adults tell of how they thought they'd gotten a galbi cornered, only to have it jump to freedom. A galbi's hind limb was oversized and extremely powerful, sometimes propelling the animal as much as 15 feet in the air. True to Melzar's word, the forest began to change as they reached a gentle downhill slope. The trees were spread out and shorter, allowing pillars of sunlight to swarm down. Grass grew again, swiftly becoming an unbroken stratum. Bushes grew in the long gaps between trees, their leaves ranging from vivid green to dark amethyst. Eddiard could not name more than a handful of the berries he could see. There must have been dozens of varieties. As the light and humidity increased, the eyeflies and bite wings began to appear. Soon they were swirling overhead in huge clumps before zooming down to nip all the available human skin. Eddiard constantly was using his third hand to ward them off. They stopped the carts by a small river and corralled the genistars. That was when Melzar finally distributed the 5 revolvers and 2 rifles he had been carrying. The majority belonged to the village, though Genril had his own revolver, which he said had been in his family since the arrival. Its barrel was longer than that of the others and made of a whitish metal that was a lot lighter than the sturdy gun-grade steel produced by the Weapons Guild in Macathran.
"Carved from the ship itself," Genril said proudly as he checked the mechanism.
Even that snicked and whirred with a smoothness that the city-made pistols lacked.
"My first ancestor salvaged some of the hull before the tides took the ship down into the belly of the sea. It's been in our family ever since." Crap, Oberon snorted. That would mean it's over 2,000 years old.
So, Genril challenged as he squeezed some oil out of a small can, rubbing it into the components with a soft linen cloth.
The shipbuilders knew how to make really strong metal. Think about Tichimorons. They had to have strong metal. The ship fell out of the sky and still survived. And in the universe they came from, ships flew between planets.
Ediard did not say anything. He'd always been sceptical about the whole ship legend, though he had to admit it was a great legend.
Melzar slung one of the rifles over his shoulder and came around with a box of ammunition. He handed out 6 of the brass bullets to each of the apprentices who had been given a revolver.
That's quite enough, he told them when there were complaints about needing more. If you can't hit a Galby after 6 shots, it's either jumped back out of range or it's happily eating your liver. Either way, that's all you get.
Only 5 apprentices had been given a gun, including Genril. Ediard was not one of them. He looked on enviously as they slid the bullets into the revolving chamber. Melzar crouched and began to draw lines in the earth.
Gather around, he told them. We're going to split into 2 groups. The shooters will be lined up along the ridge back there.
His hand waved into the forest where the land rose sharply.
The rest of us will act as the flushers. We form a long line with one end there, which will move forward in a big curve until we're level with the first shooter. That should force anything bigger than a dragon out in front of us and hopefully into the firing line. Under no circumstances does anyone go past the first shooter. I don't care if you're best friends and using long talk. You do not walk in front of the guns. Understood?
Yes, sir. They all chorused.
Okay, then. After the first sweep, we'll change over the guns and move to a new location.
He glanced up at the sky, which was starting to cloud over.
There'll be enough light to do this 3 times this afternoon, which will give everyone a chance to use a pistol.
Sir, my father said only I can use our pistol, Genril said.
I know, Melzar said. You get to hang on to it, but not the ammunition when you're in the flusher line. Now, if you're a part of the flusher line, you must keep within farsight perception of the people on either side. So in reality, that means I want you spaced no more than 70 yards apart. Orders to start, stop, and group together will be issued vocally and in long talk. You will relay both along the line. You will obey them at all times. The flusher line will use 3 G-wolves to help encourage the Galbies to run. This time, Ediard and Elsie will control 1 each, and I will take the 3rd. No one else is to order them. I don't want them confused. Any questions? No? Good, let's go. And the lady smile on us.
Ediard called one of the G-wolves over and set off in the group following Melzar. Toran, one of the farmers, led the pistol carriers up toward the stony ridge.
I don't see the point of this,
Fahin complained grimly as he hiked beside Ediard.
We've all done pistol shooting at the targets outside the walls, and Galbies aren't edible.
Don't you listen to anything, Janine said. This is all about experience. There's a world of difference between firing at a target and being out here in the woods with dangerous animals charging. The Elder Council needs to know they can rely on us to defend the village in an emergency.
Except Melzar told us the nomad families aren't threatening, Ediard thought. So what is the village wall actually for?
I must ask Akeem when I get back.
What if the Galbies don't go toward the shooting line? Fahin said.
What if they come at us?
He gripped his satchel tighter, as if it could shield him from the forest's animals.
They won't, Ediard said. They'll try to avoid us because we're a group.
Yeah, in theory, Fahin grumbled.
Quit whining for the lady's sake, Oberon said. Melzar knows what he's doing. He's done this with every caravan for the last 50 years. Besides, Galbies aren't all that dangerous. They just look bad. If one comes at you, use your 3rd hand to shield yourself.
What if we flush out a fast fox?
The apprentice groaned.
Fast foxes live down on the plains, an exasperated Alcee said. They're not mountain animals. You're more likely to get one in Ashwell than here.
Fahin pulled a face, not convinced. As they approached the edge of the forest again, Melzar used his long talk to tell them,
start to spread out. Remember, keep the people on both sides within your farsight. If you lose contact, long talk them.
Edyard had Oberon on one side and Fahin on the other. He was not too happy about that. If anyone was going to screw up, it would be Fahin. The lanky boy really wasn't an outdoors type, and Oberon wasn't likely to help either of them. But the worst thing Fahin can do is fall behind. It's not like he's got a pistol, and he'll yell hard enough if he can't see us. He sent the G-Wolf ranging from side to side. The mood of excitement was filling his farsight, the minds of everyone in the Flusher line twinkling with anticipation. They moved forward, slowly spreading out as Melzar directed, until they had formed the line. The trees were growing tall again, their dark green canopy insulating the apprentices from the cloudy sky. "Move forward," Oberon ordered. Edyard smiled and repeated the instruction to Fahin, who grimaced. Edyard was pleased that he had kept his new boots on. The forest floor was littered with sticks among rotting clumps of grass, uneven ground with plenty of sharp stones. His ankles were sore where the new leather pinched, yet the boots protected his feet well enough. With his farsight scouring the land ahead, he kept a slow pace, making sure the line stayed straight. Melzar told them to start making a racket. Oberon was shouting loudly, and Fahin let out piercing whistles. For himself, Edyard picked up a thick stick and thwacked it against the tree trunks as he passed by. There were more bushes in this part of the forest, big zebra thorns with their monochrome patterned leaves and oozing highly poisonous white berries and coal leaves that were like impenetrable black clouds squatting on the earth. Small creatures were exposed to his farsight, zipping out of the way of the humans, nothing big enough to be a dragon, let alone a galby. The ground became soft under his feet, wet loam that leaked water from every footprint. The scent of mouldering leaf was strong in his nose. He was sure he could smell fungus spores. Oberon was out of eyesight now, somewhere behind the bushes. Edyard's farsight picked him up on the other side of dense trunks. "Close up a little," he long talked.
"Sure, sure," Oberon replied casually.
A ripple of excitement went down the line. Somewhere up toward Melzar's end, a galby sped away, not quite in the direction of the shooting line. Edyard's heart started to beat quickly. He knew he was smiling and didn't care. This was the kind of thing he had wanted ever since he had learned he was going on the caravan. There were galbies here. He would get a chance to flush one, and if he was really lucky, maybe take a shot later on. Something squawked above him. Edyard flicked his farsight focus upward, in time to see a couple of birds dart up through the canopy. There was a thicket up ahead, a dense patch of zebra thorn, just the kind of place for a galby to nest in. His farsight swept through it, but there were dark zones and steep little gullies he could not be sure about. He sent the G-Wolf slinking in through the bushes as he skirted the outside. Now he couldn't see Fahin either, but his farsight registered the boy's mind. Apprehension hit him like a solid force, the mental equivalent of being doused in icy water. Suddenly all his delight deserted him. His fingers actually lost their grip on the stick as his legs seized up. Something terrible was happening. He knew it. "What?" he gasped. He was frightened, and worse, frightened that he was frightened. This makes no sense. In the middle of the thicket, the G-Wolf he was directing lifted its head and snarled, responding to the turmoil bubbling along his tenuous long-talk contact. "Edyard?" Fahin called. "What's wrong?" "I don't..." Edyard pulled his arms in by his sides as his knees bent, lowering him to a crouch. He instinctively closed his third hand around himself to form the strongest shield he was capable of. "Lady, what's the matter with me?" He pushed his farsight out as far as he could and swept around as if it were some kind of illuminating beam. The tree trunks were too dense to get any kind of decent picture of anything beyond his immediate vicinity. "What is the matter with you?" Oberon asked. His mental tone was scathing. Edyard could sense both apprentices hesitating. The G-Wolf was wriggling around, trying to get out of the thicket and back to him. Dry leaves rustled, and he whirled around, raising the stick protectively. "I think someone's here." He directed his farsight where he thought the sound had come from, pushing its focus as hard as he could. There were a few tiny rodent creatures scuttling along the forest floor. They could have made the noise.
"What do you mean, someone?" Fahin demanded. "Who?"
Edyard was gritting his teeth with the effort of extending his farsight to the limit.
"I don't know. I can't sense them." "Hey, we're falling behind,"
Oberon Long talked impatiently.
"Come on, get moving."
Edyard stared back into the forest. This is stupid. But he could not get rid of his dread. He took a last look at the forest behind, then turned. The arrow came out of the empty trees on his left, moving so fast that he never saw it. Only his farsight caught the slightest ripple of motion. His shield tightened as he gasped, his mind clamoring its shock. The arrow hit his left pectoral muscle. His telekinetic shield held, but the force of impact was sufficient to knock him backward. He landed on his ass. The arrow tumbled down in the loam and weeds beside him, a long, blackened shaft with dark green needlehawk feathers and a wicked barbed metal tip dripping a thick violet liquid. Edyard stared at it in horror.
"Edyard?"
His mind was swamped by the telepathic voices. It seemed as if the entire Flusherline was shouting mentally at him, demanding an answer.
"Arrow!"
he broadcast back at them as forcefully as he could. His eyes did not move from the arrow lying beside him, showing everyone.
"Poison! Arrow!"
A mind materialized 30 yards away, sparkling vivid sapphire amid the cluttered grey shadows that comprised Edyard's ethereal vision of the forest.
"Huh?"
Edyard jerked his head around. A man stepped out from behind a tree, dressed in a ragged cloak that was almost the same color as the tree trunks. His hair was wild, long and braided, filthy with dark red mud. More mud was smeared across his face and caked his beard. He was snarling, anger and puzzlement leaking out of his mind. One hand reached over his shoulder and pulled another arrow from his quiver. He notched it smoothly into the biggest bow Edyard had ever seen, leveling it as his arm pulled back. Edyard screamed with voice and mind, a sound he could hear replicated along the Flusher line. Even his assailant winced as he let fly. Edyard thrust his hands out. A motion he followed with his third hand, using his full strength. The arrow burst into splinters before it had covered half the distance between them. This time it was the forest man who radiated shock into the ether.
"Bandits!"
Malzar's call echoed faintly around Edyard, spoken and telepathic.
"It's an ambush! Group together, everyone! Combine your strength! Shield yourselves! Tauran, help us!"
Edyard was scrambling to his feet, vaguely aware of other shouts and adrenaline-boosted emotional pulses reverberating across the forest. More bandits were emerging from concealment. Arrows were being fired. His mind reached for the G-Wolf, directing it with frenzied urgency. There was not going to be time. The forest man had slung his bow to the ground and was charging. A knife glinted in his hand. A telekinetic shove nearly knocked Edyard back to the ground. He countered it easily, feeling the force slither over his skin like icy fingers. The bandit was trying for a heart squeeze, an attack method that apprentices talked about in nervous awe when they gathered in Ashwell. Using telekinesis inside someone else's body was the ultimate taboo. Anyone found to have committed the act was exiled forever. Now a bandit was thundering toward Edyard, knife ready and death lust fevering his mind. His third hand was scrabbling to assail vulnerable organs. His earlier fear had left Edyard. He wasn't even thinking about the others. A maniac was seriously trying to kill him. That was the whole universe. And as Akeem had explained during their all-too-brief sessions on defensive telekinetic techniques, there was no such thing as a disabling blow. Edyard stood up and let his arms drop to his side, closing his eyes. He shaped his third hand, waiting. The pounding of the bandit's bare feet on the forest floor reached his ears, waiting. The man's berserker cry began. The knife rose, gripped by white knuckles. Wait. Judge the moment. Edyard's farsight revealed the man in perfect profile. He even perceived the leg muscles exerting themselves to the limit as they began the leap. Any second... The attempted heart squeeze ended. Telekinesis was channeled to assist the attack leap, to strengthen the knife thrust. Now! The bandit left the ground. Ediard pushed his third hand underneath the airborne figure and shoved, the effort forcing a wild roar from his throat. He'd never exerted himself so much before, not even when Oberon's torment was at its worst. In an instant, the bandit's semi-triumphant scream turned to pure horror. Ediard opened his eyes to see a pair of mud-encrusted feet sail over his head. "Fuck you!" he bellowed, and added the slightest corrective sideways shove to the trajectory. The bandit's head smashed into a bulky tree 4 yards above the ground. It made a horrible thud. Ediard withdrew his third hand. The man dropped like a small boulder, emitting a slight moan as he struck the ground. The G-Wolf pounced. Ediard turned away. All his emotions returned with tidal wave power as the G-Wolf began tearing and clawing at the inert flesh. He had forgotten just how fierce the creatures were. His legs were threatening to collapse under him. They were shaking so bad, while his stomach heaved. The loud crack of shots ripped across the forest. They made Ediard spin around in alarm. "That has to be us, right?" There were shouts and cries all around. Ediard did not know what to do. One of the cries was high-pitched. "Janine." "Lady, please!" Oberon wailed. His mind was pouring out dread like a small nova. Ediard's farsight flashed out. Two fast foxes were racing straight at the weeping apprentice. He had never seen one before, but knew instantly what they were. Only just smaller than a G-Wolf, but faster, especially on the sprint, it was a streamlined predator with a short ebony fur stiff enough to act like armor. Its head was either fangs or horns, and way too many of both. Its hind limb was thick and strong, allowing it a long sprint-jump motion as the ultimate lunge at its prey. They had collars on. Ediard started running toward them and reached out with his third hand. They were 40 yards away, yet he still felt their metal-hard muscles flexing in furious rhythm. He didn't even know if they had hearts like humans and terrestrial beasts, let alone where they were, so forget a heart squeeze. His telekinesis penetrated the brain of the leading one and simply shredded all the tissue he found there. It dropped in mid-bound, its flaccid body ploughing a furrow through the carpet of dry leaves. The remaining fast fox lurched aside, its demon head swinging around to try to find the threat. It stopped, growling viciously as Ediard trotted up, limbs bent as it readied itself to pounce.
"What are you doing?" Oberon bawled.
Ediard knew he was acting crazy, but did not care. Adrenaline was powering him recklessly. He snarled back at the fast fox, almost laughing at it. Then, before the creature could move, he closed his third hand on it and lifted it clean off the ground. The fast fox screeched in fury. Its limbs ran against nothing, pumping so fast they were a blur.
"Are you doing that?"
an incredulous Oberon asked.
"Yeah,"
Ediard grinned.
"Oh, crap! Look out!"
3 bandits were running toward them. They were dressed the same as the one who had attacked Ediard. Simple ragged camouflage cloaks and belts with several dagger sheaths. One of them carried a bow. Ediard sent out a single long-talk command, summoning the G-Wolf. The bandits were slowing. Consternation began to glimmer in their minds as they saw the furious fast fox scrabbling uselessly in mid-air. More gunshots rang through the forest.
"Protect yourself,"
Ediard ordered sharply as the bandit with a bow notched an arrow. Oberon's shield hardened. The 3 bandits came to a halt, still staring disbelievingly at the writhing fast fox. Ediard rotated the predator slowly and deliberately until it was pointing directly at them. He was studying the animal's thoughts, noting the simple motivational currents. It was similar to a Genistar mind, although the strongest impulses seemed to be fear-derived. Some kind of punishment-reward training, probably. The bandit with the bow shot his arrow. Oberon yipped as Ediard confidently swiped it aside. There was another pause as the bandits watched it clatter against a tree. Telekinetic fingers skittered across Ediard's skin, easily warded off. All 3 bandits drew short swords. Ediard slammed an order into the fast fox's mind, sensing its original compulsions changing. It stopped trying to run and snarled at the bandits. One of them gave it a startled look. Ediard dropped it lightly on the ground. "Kill," he purred. The fast fox moved with incredible speed. Then its hind limb slapped the earth and powered it forward in a low arc. Telekinetic shields hardened around the bandits. Against one demented predator they might have stood a chance, but the G-Wolf hit them from the side.
"Oh, lady!"
Oberon shuddered as the screaming began. He paled at the carnage, yet could not pull his gaze away.
"Come on!"
Ediard caught his arm. "We have to find Fahin. Melzar said to join up." Oberon stumbled forward. A burst of pistol fire reverberated through the trees. It must be from the shooting line, Ediard thought. They've come to help. The turbulent shouting was turning into distinct calls. Ediard heard several apprentice names yelled. Long talk was hysterical snatches of thought, mostly overwhelmed with emotional outpourings. A few raw visions threatened to overwhelm him. Pain twinned with blood was pumping out from a long gash in Alcy's thigh. An arrow stuck out of a tunic, numbness from its entry point spreading quickly. Mud-caked faces bobbed as punches were thrown. Impact pain. A camouflaged bandit was sprinting between trees as the rifle barrel tracked. A fast fox was a streak of grey-black. Blood was forming a huge puddle around a torn corpse. Ediard ran around to the side of the zebra-thorn thicket.
"Fine, fine, it's us. Where are you?"
He could not see anyone. There was no revealing glimmer of thought in his farsight.
"Fine!" "He's gone," Oberon panted. "Did they get him? Oh, lady!"
"Is there any blood?" Ediard was scanning the leaves and soil.
"Nothing. Oh!"
Ediard followed Oberon's gaze and caught sight of a bandit running through the woods. The man had a sword in his hand that was dripping with blood. Anger surged through Ediard, and he reached out with his third hand, yanking at the man's ankle, then pushing him down hard. As the bandit fell, Ediard twisted the sword, bringing the blade vertical. The bandit's agonized bellow as he was impaled made Ediard recoil in shock. The man's dying mind wept with frustration and anguish. Then the glimmer of thought was extinguished.
"He was 50 yards away,"
Oberon whispered in astonishment, and no small measure of apprehension.
"Fahin!"
Ediard called.
"Fahin, can you hear me?"
His farsight picked out a tiny iridescent glow that suddenly appeared inside the thicket.
"Fahin! Ediard?"
the lanky boy's long talk asked fearfully.
"Yes, yes, it's me and Oberon. Come on, come out, it's safe, I think."
They both watched as Fahin crawled out of the bushes. His face and hands had been scratched mercilessly. His loose woolen sweater was missing completely. Tacky berry juice was smeared into his hair and over his glasses, which hung from one ear. Amazingly, he was still clutching his physic satchel. Oberon helped him up and abruptly found himself being hugged.
"I was so frightened,"
Fahin mumbled piteously.
"I fled. I'm sorry. I should have helped."
"It's okay," Oberon said. "I wasn't much use either." He turned and gave Ediard a long, thoughtful look, his mind tightening pensively. "Ediard saved me. He's killed a score of them." "No," Ediard protested, "nothing like that." He trailed off as he realized he really had killed people that day. His guilty glance stole back to the bandit impaled on his own sword. A man was dead, and he had done it. But the sword had been slick with blood, and the other bandits would have killed them. "I didn't have a choice." Sometimes you have to do what's wrong in order to do what's right.
"Can anyone still see or sense bandits?"
Ediard's head came up as he received Melzar's weak, long talk. Oberon and Fahin also were looking around.
"Anyone?" Melzar asked. "Okay, then please make your way toward me. If anyone is injured, please help bring them along. Fahin, are you here?"
Somehow Melzar, being alive, made the world a little less intimidating for Ediard. He even managed a small grin. Oberon let out a whistle of relief.
"Yes, sir, I'm here,"
Fahin replied.
"Good lad. Hurry up, please. We have injured."
"Oh, lady," Fahin groaned. "I'm just an apprentice. The doctor won't even let me prepare some of her leaves."
"Just do the best you can," Ediard said.
"But..."
"You cured our hangovers," Ediard said.
Nobody will start mouthing off at you for helping the injured. We're not expecting you to be as good as old Doc Senio. But fine, you have to do something. You can't turn your back on wounded people. You just can't. They need you.
He's right, Oberon said. I think I heard Janine scream. What would her parents say if you walked away?
Right, yes, Fahin said. You're right, of course. Oh, lady, where are my glasses? I can't do everything by farsight.
He turned back to the thicket. They're here, Ediard said. His third hand lifted them gently into place, at the same time wiping the berry goop from them.
Thank you,
Fahin said. They hurried through the forest toward Melzar. Other figures were moving with them in the same direction. Several apprentices sent panicky hellos via long talk. Ediard remembered an image of Alcy and the wound in his thigh. It had looked bad. Torren and the apprentices, with pistols, had gathered into a defensive group with Melzar. Ediard exchanged a relieved greeting with Genril, who was all jitters. He said he had one bullet left in his revolver, and he was sure he had hit at least one bandit.
I got really scared when the fast foxes charged us. Torren killed one with his rifle. Lady! He's a good shot.
You should see what Ediard did, Oberon said flatly. He doesn't need guns.
What?
Genril asked.
What did you do?
Nothing, Ediard said. I know how to deal with animals, that's all. You know that.
Just how strong are you? Oberon asked.
Yeah, Genril said. We heard your long talk right over on the ridge. It was like you were next to me, screaming into my skull. Lady, I almost ducked when that arrow came at you.
Does it matter? Ediard asked. He was looking around, wondering where the others were. Out of the 12 apprentices and 4 adults in the flusher line, only 5 had made it back so far, including the 3 of them. Then Kanan the carpenter arrived, carrying an unconscious Alcy. Fahin gave his friend a worried look, seeing the crudely wrapped wound already soaked in blood. His mind started to get agitated.
Go,
Ediard directed with quiet long talk. Do as much as you can.
Put him down,
Fahin said. He knelt beside Alcy and started rummaging through his satchel. Ediard turned back to the forest, sending his far sight ranging out.
Where are the others?
His heart quickened as he detected some movement. A couple of apprentices came running through the trees.
It's all right, Melzar said soothingly. You're safe now.
We left Janine,
one of them wailed.
We tried to save her, but she took an arrow. I ran.
He collapsed on the ground, sobbing.
9, Ediard whispered as he kept his vigil. 9 out of 12.
Melzar's hand came down on his shoulders.
It would have been none without you,
he said quietly. Your warning saved us. Saved me, in fact. I owe you my life, Ediard.
We all do.
No.
Ediard shook his head sadly. I didn't warn you. I was terrified, that was all. You heard my fear.
I know. It was powerful.
What happened? What tipped you off? He frowned, remembering the sensation of fear that had gripped him. There was no reason for it.
I heard something, he said lamely.
Whatever.
I'm glad.
Why couldn't we sense them? I thought I had good farsight. They were closer to me than Oberon and Fahin, and I never knew.
There are ways you can eclipse your thoughts, bend them away from farsight. It's not a technique we're very familiar with in Ashwell, and I've never seen it practiced so well as today. The lady knows where they learned it, and they tamed fast foxes, too. That's astonishing. We'll have to send messengers out to the other towns and warn them of this new development.
Do you think there are more of them out there? Ediard could imagine whole armies of bandits converging on their little caravan.
No, we put them to flight today. And even if there were others lurking about, they have pause for thought now. Their ambush failed, thanks to you.
I bet Janine and the others don't think it's failed, Ediard said bitterly. He didn't care that he was being rude to Melzar. After this, nothing much seemed to matter.
There's no answer I can give you to that, lad. I'm sorry.
Why do they do this? Ediard asked. Why do these people live out here, hurting others? Why don't they live in the villages, in a house? They're just savages.
I know, lad. But this is all they know. They're brought up in the wild, and they'll bring their children up the same way. It's not a cycle we can break. There are always going to be people living beyond civilization.
I hate them.
They killed my parents. Now they've killed my friends. We should wipe them out. All of them. It's the only way we'll ever be allowed to live in peace. That's anger talking. I don't care. That's what I feel. That's what I'll always feel. It probably is. Right now, I almost agree with you. But it's my job to get everyone home safely. Melzar leaned in close, studying Ediard's expression and thoughts. Are you going to help me with that?
Yes, sir.
I will. Okay. Now call back our G-Wolves.
Right.
What about the fast fox? Ediard was still aware of the animal prowling at the limit of his farsight. It was confused, missing its original master.
The fast fox?
Ediard tamed it, Oberon said. His third hand scooped it up, and he made it attack the bandits. The other apprentices turned to look at Ediard. Despite the exhaustion and apprehension dominating their thoughts, a lot of them were registering surprise and even some concern.
I told you, Ediard said sullenly. I know how to deal with animals. It's what my whole guild does.
Nobody's ever tamed a fast fox, Torren said.
Melzar flashed him an annoyed glance.
The bandits did, Genril said. I saw the collars on them.
They'd already learned to obey, Ediard explained. My orders were stronger. That's all.
All right,
Melzar said. Call the fast fox in. If you can control it, we'll use it to guard the caravan. If not, well, he patted his rifle. But I'll warn you now, lad. The village elders won't allow you to keep it.
Chapter 3. In Aaron's opinion, Riassi had benefited from being stripped of its capital city status. It retained the grand structures intrinsic to any capital, as well as the expansive public parks, a well-financed transport grid, and excellent leisure facilities. Yet with the ministries and their bureaucrats decamped across the ocean to Makathran II, the stress and hassle had been purged from everyday life. So had exorbitant housing costs. What was left was a rich city with every possible amenity. Consequently, its residents were kicking back and enjoying themselves. It made things a lot easier for Aaron. The taxi flight from Makathran II had taken 9 hours. They had landed at the spaceport, one of hundreds of identical arrivals. Mercifully, Corilin had spent most of the journey asleep. When she did wake up, she placidly did whatever he told her. So they moved through the vast passenger terminus on the pedwalks, visiting just about every lounge. Only then did he go back to the taxi rank and take a trip to the old Parliament building at the centre of the city. It was late morning by then, with a lot of activity in the surrounding district. They swapped taxis again and then again. 3 taxis later they finally touched down in a residential zone on the east bank of the Camor River. During the flight from Makathran II, Aaron had rented a ground-floor apartment in a 15-story tower. It was anonymous enough. A safe house, he called it. To Corilin it probably seemed secure. Aaron knew his multiple taxi journeys and untraceable coin payment for the apartment were strictly amateur stuff. Any half-decent police officer could track them down within a day. For 2 days he did nothing. It took Corilin the entire first day just to sober up. He allowed her to order anything she wanted by way of clothes and food, but forbade any alcohol or aerosols. For the second day, she just sulked, a state exacerbated by a monster hangover. He knew there was plenty of trauma involved too, as she reconciled what had happened with Captain Manby's squad. That night, he heard her crying in her room. Aaron decided to go all out with breakfast the next morning to try and reach through her mood. He combined the culinary unit's most sophisticated synthesis with items delivered fresh from a local delicatessen. The meal started with Oberon bluefruit, followed by French toast with caramelized banana. The main course was buckwheat crepes with fried duck eggs, grilled uban mushroom, and smoked Ayrshire bacon, topped by a delicate omelette au caviar. The tea was genuine Assam, which was all he could ever drink in the morning. It was not his best time of day.
"Wow-wee," Corilin said in admiration.
She had wandered in from her bedroom all bleary-eyed, dressed in a fluffy blue toweling robe. When she saw what was being laid out, she perked up immediately.
"There's sugar for the blue fruit," he told her. "It's refined from Dranscombe tubers, best in the galaxy." Corilin sprinkled some of the silvery powder over the blue fruit and tried a segment. "Mmm, that is good." She spooned out some more. Aaron sat opposite her and took his first sip of tea. The table was next to a window wall, giving them a view across the river. Several big ocean-going barges were coasting along just above the rippling water. Smaller river traffic curved around them. He didn't see them. His eyes were on the loose front of her robe, which revealed the slope of her breasts. Firm and excellently shaped, he admired cheerfully. She certainly had a great body, his gaze tracking down to her legs to confirm it. There were no mental directives either way on having sex with her, so he suspected the hormonal admiration was all his own. It made him grin. Normal, after all. "You're not a starship leasing agent," Corilin said abruptly, her face pulled up in a peeved expression. He realized he was allowing some of his feelings to ooze out into the Gaia field. "No. So what are you?" "Some kind of secret agent, I guess."
"You guess?"
"Yeah. Don't you know?"
"Not really."
"What do you mean?"
"Simple enough. If I don't know anything, I can't reveal anything. I just have things I know I have to do."
"You mean you haven't got any memories of who you are?"
"Not really, no."
"Do you know who you're working for?"
"No."
"So how do you know you should be working for them?"
"Excuse me?"
"How do you know you're not working for the Orcusan Empire? That you're not helping bring down the Greater Commonwealth? Or what if you're a leftover Starflyer agent? They say Paula Mayo never did catch all of them."
"Unlikely, but admittedly I don't know."
"Then how can you live with yourself?"
"I think it's improbable that I'm doing something like that. If you asked me to do it now, I wouldn't. So I wouldn't have agreed to do it before my full memory was removed."
"Your full memory?"
Corilin tasted the idea with the same care with which she had sampled the blue fruit.
"Anyone who agrees to have their memory taken out, just to get an illegal contract, has got to be pretty extreme. And you kill people, too. You're good at it."
"My combat software was superior to theirs. And they'll be re-lifed. Your friend Captain Manby is probably already walking around looking for us. Think how much improved his motivation is now, thanks to me."
"Without your memories, you can't know what your true personality is."
Aaron reached for his French toast.
"And your point is, for Ozzy's sake, doesn't that trouble you?"
"No."
She shook her head in amazement.
"That's got to be an artificial feeling." "Again, so what? It makes me efficient at what I do. Personality trait realignment is a useful procedure in real life. If you want to be a management type, then have your neural structure altered to give yourself confidence and aggression. Choose a vocation and mold yourself to fit."
"Great.
That's so human.
Now then, what's your definition of human these days? Higher? Advancer? Originals? How about the Hive?
Huxley's Haven has kept a regulated society functioning for close to 1,500 years, every one of them proscribed by genetic determination, and they're still going strong, with a population that's healthy and happy. Now you tell me plain and clear, which of us won the human race?
I'm not arguing evolution with you. Besides, it's just a distraction from what you are."
"I thought we'd agreed that neither of us knows what I am. Is that what fascinates you about me?"
"In your pervert dreams."
Aaron grinned and crunched some toast.
"So what's your mission?"
Corilin asked.
"What do you have to do? Kidnap living dream counselors?"
"Ex-counselors, but no. That's not the way of it."
"So what do you want with me?"
"I need to find Inigo. I believe you can help."
Corilin dropped her spoon and stared at him in disbelief.
"You've got to be kidding."
"No.
You expect me to help you? After what you just said?"
"Yes. Why not?"
"But,"
she sputtered.
"Living Dream is trying to kill you. Understand this. They're not going to stop. If anything, the other night will only make them more determined. the only person left in the galaxy who can put the brakes on your dear new cleric conservator is Inigo himself. So that's who you're working for. The anti-pilgrimage lobby. There's no guarantee that Inigo will stop the pilgrimage if he comes back. You know him better than anybody. Do I speak the right in that? She nodded forlornly.
Yeah, I think you might be.
So help me find him.
I can't do that,
she said in a low voice.
How can you ask, when even you don't know what you'll do to him if we find him?
Anyone who has hidden himself this well is never going to be taken by surprise, even if we do manage to track him down. He knows there are a lot of serious people looking for him. Besides, if I wanted to kill him, why would I take the trouble of hunting him down? If he's off the stage, he can't direct any of the actors now, can he? So if I want him back, I must want him back intact.
I don't know,
she said weakly. I saved your life. Corilyn gave him a sly smile.
The software running you saved my life. It did it because you needed me. I'm your best hope, remember?
You're my number one choice.
Better get ready to schmooze number two.
Not even my liver could take another night in Rakus. I do need you, Corilyn. And what about you? What do you need? Don't you want to find him? Don't you want to hear why he upped and left you, and all the billions who believed in him? Did he lose faith? Was Living Dream just that, all along, nothing more than a dream?
Low blow.
You can't do nothing. You're not that kind of person. You know Inigo must be found before the pilgrimage leaves. Somebody will find him. Nobody can stay hidden forever, not in this universe. Politics simply won't allow it. Who do you want to find him?
I can't,
Corilyn said. I understand. I can wait, at least for a little while longer.
Thanks.
She put her head down and started to eat her French toast, almost as if she were ashamed of the decision. Aeron did not see her for nearly 3 hours after breakfast. She went back into her bedroom and stayed there. His U-Shadow monitored a small amount of Unisphere use. She was running through standard information files from the Living Dream Fanes in the city. He had a shrewd idea what she was looking for. A friend she could trust, which meant things could well be swinging his way. If they set foot outside, it would not be long before Manby or his replacement was racing up behind them, guns flaring. When she came out, she was wearing a loose-necked red sweater and tight black trousers. A silver necklace made a couple of long loops around her neck before wrapping around her hips. She had fluffed her dark hair neatly and infused it with purple and green sparks that glimmered on a long cycle. He gave her an appreciative smile, which she ignored.
I need to talk to someone,
she announced. Aeron tried to make his smirk not too obvious.
Sure thing.
I hope you're not going to insist on going alone. There are bad people out there.
You can come with me, but the conversation is private.
Okay. Can I ask if you've already set up a meeting?
No.
Good. Don't call anyone. The Elezalin cybersphere has government monitors in its nodes. Manby's team will fall on you like a planet-killer asteroid. Her expression flickered with worry.
I already accessed the Unisphere.
That's okay. They probably can't trace your U-Shadow access, he lied. Do you know where this person is likely to be?
The Deus Fane. That's over on the south side of the city.
Right then. We'll take a taxi to that district and land a couple of blocks away. Once we're at the Fane, we'll try to get a visual on your friend.
He's not a friend, she said automatically.
Aeron shrugged. Whoever the person is. If we find him, then you can have your chat in private. Calling him is our last resort, and please, let me do that. My U-Shadow has fixes available that should circumvent the monitor systems. She nodded agreement, picked up her scarlet bag and wrapped a long, fawn-colored scarf around her shoulders.
Let's go.
Aeron was perfectly relaxed in the taxi flight over the city. He spent it looking down on the buildings, enjoying the vertical perspective as the towers flipped past underneath. The inhabitants certainly enjoyed their roof gardens. Nearly half of them had some kind of terrace fenced in by greenery, and swimming pools were everywhere. He did not know what the outcome of Corilin's meeting would be, nor did he really care. His only certainty was that he would know exactly what to do when the time came. There was, he reflected, a lot of comfort to be had in his unique level of ignorance. They landed on an intersection at the edge of the Deas district. It was a commercial area dominated by the monolithic buildings that had been the Elezalin off-world office, the ministry that had masterminded the free market zone, and Elezalin's subsequent commercial and diplomatic domination of neighboring star systems. The structure had been turned into hotels, casinos, and exclusive malls. They walked along the ornate stone facades toward the fane, with Aaron making sure they didn't take a direct route. He wanted time to scan and check for possible hostiles. Make that probable hostiles. "Did you know he was leaving before he actually went?" Aaron asked. Corilin gave him an unsettled glance.
"No," she sighed. "But we'd cooled off quite a while back. I hadn't been excluded exactly, but I wasn't in the inner circle anymore."
"Who was?"
"That's the thing. No one, really. Inigo had been getting more and more withdrawn for a long time. Years. Because we were so close, it took time for me to notice how distant he was growing. You know what it's like."
"I can imagine," he said, which earned him a frown. "So there was no one event, then?"
"Ah. You're talking about the fabled last dream, aren't you?"
"No, not that I was aware. But then that rumor had to come from somewhere." Even before they won a majority in Parliament, the Living Dream's chief councillor of Riasa had boasted that one could never travel more than a mile in the city without encountering a fane. The buildings did not have a specific layout. Anything that had a hall large enough to accommodate the faithful, along with office space and living quarters, would do. Given the inherent wealth of the Deas district, it was inevitable that the local fane should be impressive. A contemporary Burzaz cube, with horizontal stripes twisted at 15 degrees to each other, their fluid luminal surfaces shining with an intensity that automatically matched the sunlight, delineating each floor in a spectromatic waterfall. The overall effect was of a city block that was trying to screw itself into the ground. It was surrounded by a broad plaza with a fountain at each point. Tall jets squirted out from the center of inclined rings that were ticked out with ingrav to make the water flow upslope. Aaron scanned the bustling plaza, performing a meticulous assessment of the locale, allowing his combat software to plot escape routes. His U-Shadow was busy extracting the civic plans for the neighboring buildings, along with utility tunnels and traffic routes. Directly opposite the fane's main entrance was an arcade with a curving crystal roof, sheltering 50 high-class shops and boutiques on 3 levels. It had multiple entrances onto 3 streets, and 5 underground cargo depots, as well as 7 cab platforms and 10 rooftop landing pads. That would be difficult to cover, even for a large surveillance team. Next to it was a staid old ministry building that now housed several financial institutions and a couple of export merchants. There weren't as many ways in and out, but it did have a large subterranean garage full of expensive regrav capsules. The boulevard running alongside it was lined with shops and entertainment salons, mixed in with bars and restaurants, with the tables outside playing host to a vibrant café culture. Aaron's U-Shadow called down 3 taxis and parked them on public pads nearby, paying for them to wait with 3 independent and genuinely untraceable coin accounts.
"Do you want me to go in and try to find him?" Corilin asked.
Aaron studied the fane's main entrance, a truncated archway that the fluid luminal flowed around on either side, presenting it as a dark passageway. Plenty of people were coming and going, the majority dressed in the kind of clothes found on Querentia. Brightly coloured cleric robes were easy to spot. "I'm assuming this somebody is a Living Dream cleric, quite a senior one given your own rank." She gave him a short nod.
"Eve. He's still the deputy here. I've known him for 50 years, completely devoted to Inigo's vision."
"Old guard, then?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Not likely to bump into him running errands around the place, then. He's going to stay put in his office."
"That's on the 4th floor.
I can probably get up there. I do have some clearance. I'm not sure I can take you with me. Any clearance you had will be revoked by now, and if you interface with a living dream network, it'll send up an alert they can see back on old Earth. So what do you want to do then? If honesty doesn't pay, I have a few tricks that should be able to get us up to his office without drawing attention to ourselves. All you have to do is pray he doesn't turn us in the minute we say hello. I say hello, she emphasized. Whatever. His software had identified three probable hostiles amid the bustle of pedestrians across the plaza. Looking at the shimmering building, he got the distinct sensation of a trap waiting to snap shut. His trouble was that pointing out the three suspects wouldn't be anything like enough to convince Corilyn that she should be doing her utmost to help him. That would require a genuine scare, on the same scale as the one Captain Manby had provided back in Greater Macathran, the difference being this time she would be awake, sober, and clean. She had to realize that Living Dream was her enemy on every level. "We'll go in by the front door," he said. No sense drawing attention to ourselves by trying to sneak in the back. Each side of the fane has an entrance which leads to the main reception hall. They're all open. We welcome everyone. I was speaking metaphorically, he said. Come on. His U-Shadow told him the Raisi Metropolitan Police had just received an alert that two known political activists, known to be aggressive, had been seen in the city. Ladies and gentlemen, Elvis is well and truly back in the building, he muttered, without really knowing why. Corilyn let out a hiss of exasperation at his nonsense and headed off toward the fane's entrance. Aaron followed, smiling at her attitude. The thoughts within the plaza's Gaia field were pleasurable and enticing, a melange of sensations that made the hair along his spine stand up. It was almost as if the inside of his skull were being caressed. Something wonderful resided inside the fane. The Gaia field promised him. He just had to step inside. Aaron grinned at the crudity of the allure. It was the mental equivalent of freshly baked bread on a winter morning. He imagined it would be quite an attraction to any casual passerby. The problem he had with that was the lack of any such specimen, as the majority of Elezalin's population were all Living Dream devotees. But this fane, like all the others in the greater commonwealth, housed a Gaia field confluence nest. It was inevitable that the lure effect would be at its peak in the plaza. No one looked at them as they walked into the archway with its moiré curtain of luminescence. Aaron's level one field scan showed him that the three suspects outside had started to move toward the fane. He hoped they couldn't detect such a low-power scan. They certainly did not appear to be enriched with bionics. There were sensors built into the entrance, standard systems that were recording their faces and signatures, making sure they had no concealed weapons, the kind every public building was equipped with. Aaron's bionics deflected them easily enough. Inside, the siren call within the Gaia field slacked off, to be replaced by a single note of harmony. Decor and ether blended to give a sense of peaceful refuge. Even the air was pleasantly cool. The reception hall was a replica of the main audience chamber in the Orchard Palace, where the mayor greeted honored citizens. Here, clerics talked quietly to small groups of people. Aaron and Corilyn walked through the hall and into the cloister that led to the eastern entrance. A corridor on the right had no visible barrier. Aaron's bionic fields manipulated the electronics guarding it, and the force field disengaged. He paused, checking the building network, but there was no alarm. In we go, he told her quietly. An elevator took them up to the fourth floor, opening into a windowless corridor narrower than the one downstairs. As they stepped out, his U-Shadow informed him that the three waiting taxis had all just had their management programs examined. Aaron was undecided at what point to tell her that they were being targeted again. The longer he left it, the more difficult it would be to extricate them from the fane. He needed her just rattled enough to sign up for his mission, but not so scared that she lost all sense. With activity in the fane still at a minimum, he walked with her along several corridors, until they reached Eve's office. The room had an active screen, but Aaron's field scan could cut right through it. There was just one person inside, no enrichments showing. Corilyn put a hand lightly on Aaron's chest. "Just me," she said. Her voice had dropped to a husky tone. He couldn't tell if she was being playful or insistent. Either way, there did not seem to be a threat in the office, so he smiled gracefully and gestured at the door. Once she was inside, he walked down the rest of the corridor, checking the other rooms. A woman in plain brown and blue cleric robes came out of one after he had passed. She frowned and said, "Can I help?" Aaron shot her with a low-power stun pulse from the weapon's enrichment in his left forearm. His scrambler field severed her connection with the Unisphere as she crumpled to the floor, blocking the automatic call for help to the police and city medical service emitted by her multicellular clusters. He didn't bother scooping her up and shoving her inside an empty room. That simply was not the kind of time scale he was looking at. When he started back to Eve's office, all the elevators began to descend to the ground floor. By expanding his level one field scan to its limit, he could just detect weapons powering up down there. He walked straight into Eve's office. "We have to go," he began, then cursed silently. Corilyn was sitting on the edge of a long leather couch, with Eve slumped at the other end. Her red bag was open, an aerosol in her fist, moving hurriedly, guiltily from her face. A blissful expression weighed down her eyelids and mouth. Aaron couldn't believe that he had not checked her bag while she had been sleeping. It was completely unprofessional.
"Oh, hi," she slurred. "Eve, this is the guy I was telling you about. My savior. Aaron, this is Eve. We were just catching up."
Eve waved his hand at Aaron, producing a dreamy smile.
"Cool."
"Fuck!" Aaron shot the man with a stun pulse. He was shifting the weapon toward Corilyn when his tactical programs interrupted the action. In her current state, it would be a lot easier for him to evacuate her if she was unconscious and inert. However, she had to be aware of the danger she was in to make the right choice and confide in him. Eve tumbled backward over the end of the couch and landed on the floor with a soft thud. His legs were propped up by the end of the couch, shoes pointing at the ceiling. Corilyn stared at her old friend as his feet slowly slithered sideways.
"What are you doing?" she wailed.
"Putting my ass on the line to save yours. Can you walk?"
Corilyn hauled herself along the couch to peer down at the crumpled body.
"You killed him. Eve, oh, Ozzy, what are you, you bastard?"
He stunned, which gives him the perfect alibi. "Now, can you walk?" She turned her head to peer at Aaron. It was clearly an action that required a lot of effort.
"He's all right."
"Damn it."
He didn't have time to waste being her shrink. "Yeah, he's fine. Forget him. We have to get out of here right now." He pulled her off the couch and slung her over his shoulder. Corilyn wailed again.
"Put me down."
"You can't even stand up, let alone walk, and we need to run."
The field medic sack in his thigh opened and ejected a drug pellet. Aaron slapped it against Corilyn's neck, above the carotid.
"That should straighten you out in a minute."
"No, no, no,"
she protested. "Leave me alone."
Aaron ignored her and went out into the corridor. She was hanging over his shoulder, arms beating ineffectually at his buttocks as she cursed him loudly. Several clerics opened their doors to see what the commotion was. Aaron stunned each one as he appeared.
"What's happening?"
Corilyn slurred.
"Getting out of here. Your old friends have found us."
Her arms stopped flailing, and she started to weep. Aaron shook his head in dismay. He had thought she was more capable than this. He reached the elevator, and his bionics produced a small disruptor effect. The elevator doors cracked, their glossy surface darkening, as if he were watching them age centuries in every second. They crumbled away into dust and flakes, pouring down the shaft, where they pattered onto the top of the elevator as it stood waiting on the ground floor. Aaron tightened his grip on Corilyn and jumped down the shaft. She screamed as the darkness rushed past her, a genuine, terrified-for-her-life bellow of fear. His integral force field expanded, cushioning their landing. Another disruptor pulse flashed out from his bionics, and the top of the elevator disintegrated beneath his feet. Two very startled police officers were looking up as he fell through on top of them. Both had force field webbing, which protected them from the impact. The weapon's enrichment in Aaron's forearm had to increase its power level by 2 orders of magnitude to puncture the webbing with a stun pulse. He walked out, still carrying a silent Corrie Lynn. There were several police officers in the corridor between the elevator and the welcome hall. They shouted at him to stop, which he ignored. A barrage of energy shots smacked across his force field, encasing him and Corrie Lynn in a screeching purple nimbus. It didn't slow him down. He emerged into the welcome hall to see clerics and visitors running for cover, yelling for help vocally and digitally. Police were taking cover in the archways to 3 corridors, their weapons peppering him with shots. He fired several low-power disruptor pulses at the hall's ceiling. Thick clouds of composite fragments plummeted down, filling the air with cloying particles. Steel and carbon girders sagged, emitting dangerous groans. Police officers flinched, retreating from the collapsing hall. Aaron walked on toward the main entrance, while Corrie Lynn gasped and moaned in martyred dismay at the chaos raging around them. Outside, the city cybersphere was broadcasting distress and warning messages to anyone within 2 blocks of the Fane. People were scurrying out of the plaza, an exodus that Aaron's tactical programs decided was working against him. Sentient police software was downloading into the district's cybersphere nodes, taking charge, safeguarding the local network from any subversion he might try to activate, suspending capsule and ground traffic, monitoring sensors, sealing him in. Aaron's U-Shadow went for the unguarded systems managing the plaza's fountains, changing the direction of the ingrav effect on the angled rings. The tall jets began to waver, then suddenly swung down until they were horizontal. They slashed from side to side, hosing everyone in the plaza like giant water cannons. People went tumbling across the stone floor, buffeted by thick waves of spray. Aaron reached the Fane's entrance and began sprinting across the plaza, partially obscured from the police by the seething spume clouds. His bionics strengthened his leg muscles, the field effect amplifying and quickening every movement. He covered the first 100 meters in 7 seconds. Flailing bodies washed past him as the jets continued to play back and forth. Police officers were singled out for merciless drubbing. Their force fields did little to protect them from the powerful deluge, and they toppled easily from the soaking punches. Those who did fire energy shots into the furious spray simply created crackling vortices of ions that spit out curlicues of scalding steam. Victims on the ground scrabbled desperately out of the way as the dangerous vapor stabbed out, screamed at them to stop shooting. The fountains began to run out of water when Aaron was 2/3 of the way across the plaza. 2 energy shots hit his force field, throwing off a plume of sparks. The strike made him skid on the wet stone.
"Slow down!" Corrie Lynn yelped as he regained his footing. "Oh, Ozzy, no!"
Aaron's sensory field scanned the area. The Fane was starting to collapse, folding in on itself and twisting gently, as if in mimicry of the pattern of its fluid luminal surfaces. "I must have damaged more than I realized," he grunted. Dust and smoke were flaring out of the entrances like antique rocket engine plumes, billowing over the plaza. He reached the entrance to the arcade. People had crowded around, watching the spectacle in the plaza. When Aaron had appeared out of the chaos and started charging toward them, they had backed away fast. Now they scattered like frightened birds. No one in the Commonwealth was accustomed to civil trouble, let alone Raisi's residence. As he paused on the threshold, at least 5 police officers were given a clear line of sight. Energy slammed into his force field, producing a fearsome star blast of photons, its screeching loud enough to overwhelm Corrie Lynn's howls. Unprotected surfaces around him started to blister and smolder. He fired 3 bolts of his own, hidden in the melee, targeting structural girders around the archway. The crystal ceiling began to sag, huge cracks ripped through the thick material. Behind them, the Fane finally crumpled, the process accelerating. Chunks of debris went scything across the plaza to impact the surrounding buildings. 10s of thousands of glass fragments created a lethal shrapnel cloud racing outward. The police officers stopped shooting as they sought cover.
Corilin was sobbing hysterically at the sight. Then the arcade's archway started to disintegrate. She froze as giant daggers of the crystal roof plunged down around them. Fire alarms were yammering and bright blue suppressor foam started to pour down from the remaining nozzles overhead.
Aaron dived into the third store, which sold handmade lingerie. A slush of foam rippled out across the floor as it slid off his force field. Two remaining assistants saw him and sprinted for a fire exit. "Can you walk?" he asked Corilin. His U-Shadow was attacking the police programs in the arcade's nodes, interfering with the building's internal sensors, and trying to cut power lines directly. It sent out a call to one of the parked taxis, directing it to land at the back of the arcade. When he pulled Corilin off his shoulder, all she could do was cross her arms and hug her chest. Her legs were trembling, unable to hold her weight. "Shit!" He shunted her over his shoulder again and went into the back of the store. There was a door at the top of the stairs that led down into the basement stockroom, and he descended it quickly. His field scan showed a whole flock of police regrav capsules swooping low over the plaza, while a couple of hardy officers were making their way over the tangle of archway girders. They seemed to be carrying some very high-powered weaponry. It was cooler in the stockroom, the air dry and still. Overhead lights came on to reveal a rectangular room with smooth concrete walls filled with ranks of metal shelving. The far end was piled up with old advertising displays. His U-Shadow reported that it was having some success in blocking the police software from nearby electronics. They would know he was there, but not what he was doing. The big malmetal door to the loading bay furled aside, and he went out into the narrow underground delivery road that served all the stores. It was empty. The police prohibition on all traffic was preventing any cargo capsules from using it. 10 meters away on the other side was a hatchway into a utility tunnel. His U-Shadow popped the lock, and it swung open. He sprinted across the delivery road and clambered inside, pushing an unresisting Corilin ahead of him. The hatch snapped shut. Aaron scanned again. There was no light in the tunnel other than a yellow circle glowing around the hatch's emergency handle. It was not high enough for him to walk along. He would have to stoop. Corilin was sitting slumped against the wall, just beside the hatch.
"There are no visual sensors inside the tunnel," his U-Shadow reported. "Only fire and water alarms."
"Water. In case of flooding, it is a city regulation."
"Typical bureaucratic overkill," he muttered.
"Corilin, we have to keep going." She did not acknowledge his words. Her limbs were trembling uncontrollably, but she moved when he pushed at her. Together they shuffled along the tunnel, hunched over like monkeys. There were hatches every 50 meters. He stopped at the 6th one and let his field scan function review the immediate vicinity outside. It did not detect anyone nearby. His U-Shadow unlocked it, and they crawled out into the base of a stairwell, illuminated by blue-tinged polyphoto strips on the wall. "The building network is functioning normally," his U-Shadow said. "The police sentients are currently concentrating their monitor routines on the fane and the arcade."
"That won't last," he said. "They'll expand outward soon enough. Crack one of the private capsules for me."
He pulled Corilin to her feet, with one arm under her shoulder to support her. They went up a flight of stairs. The door opened into the underground car park of the old ministry building. His U-Shadow had infiltrated the control net of a luxury capsule and brought it right over to the stairwell.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.